Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, February 25th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Americans lost $16.6 billion to online scams in 2024, a record high, with older Americans reporting nearly $5 billion of those losses alone. And scammers are not just small-time criminals. Oh, no, there are scam centers that have evolved into industrial-scale global criminal enterprises, often run in forced labor camps across Southeast Asia. And so AI is supercharging scanning. They have scamming. They have voice cloning, deep fake websites, and social media platforms provide a critical portal between scammers and their victims. So today we're going to revisit a show that we did back in November.
It's one of our excellent show
favorite shows.
Yes.
And we're going to dig into how the scam industry operates, who it targets, why enforcement is failing, and how to protect yourselves and your loved ones. This is something we deal with all the time. You probably, if you have an email address, you're probably getting all sorts of phishing scams, people trying to get you hooked. And so we'll talk about this. And our question of the day, we'd love to hear from you, even though this is a rebroadcast. Have you or someone you love been scammed or almost scammed and you want to share your story? You can email studio2@whyy.org and we will read your email later on in the show.
But first, a trio of local news stories. Starting up in Quakertown, five teenagers are facing charges, including aggravated assault, after a clash in Quakertown between police and students who were protesting ICE. You might have heard about this incident. It's been widely covered. The video of it has gone viral. Still a lot of unanswered questions, though. Here's what we think we know. A group of students walked out of Quakertown High School on Friday protesting ICE. After they left campus, there was some sort of confrontation with police. It's a little unclear why police intervened. They initially said there were reports of disruptive behavior. Anyway, at some point in all of this, a man went into the crowd of students, grabbed one of the students, and ultimately placed one girl in a headlock. This man was not in uniform, but it turns out he was the Quakertown police chief and borough manager, Scott McElry. The students say they then reacted and, you know, tussled with the man because they thought he was a counter-protester assaulting their friend. So there's still a lot to sort through, but again, five students have been formally charged now with charges including aggravated assault, which is a felony charge.
Yeah, they're facing up to 5 years in juvenile detention. That's pretty serious. And I have to mention, according to reporting, three students were injured, one with a broken nose. Another had to get stitches to their chin. And you know, McElry, the sheriff there, or the police captain there, was also injured. And, you know, I don't know all the facts. I think the facts are still coming out. But folks, you know, it is a red flag that, you know, he didn't have on a uniform. They said that he didn't announce that he was law enforcement, and so they didn't know what was going on. So that's a red flag, but the judge will have to decide. And this is becoming a bit of a political situation in Quakertown. You know, folks are taking sides, but I will say that the students, there's a GoFundMe for them, and they've raised over $92,000 so far for their legal defense.
I'll also note that the Bucks County District Attorney says it is investigating this incident. So yeah, a lot more to come out, we assume, in the days and weeks to follow.
Yes. Our second story. If you've driven in the city near 2nd and Spring Garden Streets, you've probably seen people standing out there. We saw last night.
We were there last night.
Standing there in the
poor
cold
people
with luggage waiting for the bus. Well, I have some good news. The city's Greyhound bus terminal is one step closer to having a permanent home. Shout out to the Philadelphia Inquirer for this update. Apparently, the city looked through 200 plus locations and narrowed the options to three potential sites for a permanent terminal, a pair of parking lots near 8th and Arch, a garage at 15th and Arch, and a parking lot near 30th Street Station right near the Cira Center. Now, if you're hearing this and you're like me, you probably thought this was already decided. I thought they were moving back into the old Filbert station
where the Greyhound used to be.
And that is true. But that is just a temporary place.
Got it.
And that's the big update. I was very confused. I think we all were confused when we talk about this story. The old Filbert Street Station was recently leased by the Philadelphia Parking Authority. It's being renovated right now. It's scheduled to open in May, just in time for the 250th anniversary celebrations. But again, it's not a long-term option. It's just a stopgap solution for passengers. Because as I said, they've been standing outside, no place to eat, no place to sit. It's cold. Sometimes it's raining. They're literally standing underneath an overpass waiting for their buses. And so the thought is we'll reopen the old Filbert station. They can use that while we figure out where to permanently be long term, because the new location, whichever one they choose, will be owned by the city.
That's a key point. The old one was owned by Greyhound.
And Greyhound wanted to cut costs, so they closed up a lot of their terminals across the country. But this time it'll be owned by the city. And they're hoping that, you know, building a new terminal will spark development in that area. And, you know, they're going to be having an open house tonight at the Independence Visitor Center. They want people to give feedback, find out more about the new locations and weigh in.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bit of an embarrassment. It has been a bit of an embarrassment for the city to not have an intercity bus terminal, given how popular that form of transit is. I'm interested in these three sites. I don't know if there's one that I inherently prefer. 8th and Arch is right across the street from us.
Yeah.
So maybe selfishly I prefer that one. But 30th Street would seem to make a lot of sense. People are already
there,
traveling in and out of there. It's right next to the Amtrak station and all the, you know, regional rail. So that feels like a logical solution. Reading between the lines in the Inquirer's reporting, it sounded like that one might be a little more costly.
Mm-hmm. So and there's pros and cons to each of the locations. So,
I mean, bottom line, it's nice to hear that they're moving forward with something that the city's going to own and can have some control over and will give people a safe and warm place to wait for the bus.
Because, I mean, we saw them yesterday sitting on with ice-capped brick wall. Like,
It was bleak.
That was it. It was so sad. It was so, so sad.
All right. Story number three.
Yes.
I don't know if this will make people sad or happy. Depends maybe on your political persuasion. So a Wharton grad and tax nerd bet his entire life savings against Elon Musk and Doge, and he won.
Okay.
This story comes via the Wall Street Journal. Alan Cole is a tax economist who went to the Wharton School at Penn, just like Elon Musk. A little Wharton v. Wharton action here. Like all of us, Cole heard the hype about Doge and Elon Musk slashing federal spending. Then he realized there was a prediction market out there where you could bet on whether or not government spending would actually go up or down. And he called Doge's bluff. With the blessing of his wife, Alan Cole bet every single penny of his life savings, $342,000, on the fact that government spending would still go up. And he won, and he ended up winning $128,000.
Cha-ching!
He bet it all.
Cha-ching.
The house. We talk about betting the house. He actually bet the house. And of course, government spending has continued to increase, even with the reductions that Doge did make. Overall spending, still up.
Smart man. Trump should have hired him. Had him working in there. Maybe would have saved some jobs and a whole lot of political capital. But I got to shout out the fact that Cole got his wife's blessing before he bet the life savings.
He's a wife guy.
Yeah. And she knew her husband wasn't an expert on this, but he was making a well-educated guess. He was really smart about it. He bounced his thesis off a few smart people.
Yeah.
And
he knows people.
Thought he would win, and then he bet the house, literally, and won big.
My concern would be that somehow the betting market would find some loophole to not pay out. But they paid out, and it all went well.
And after taxes, it's a pretty, because he's a tax guy. I mean, after taxes, it's still a good haul.
It's a decent haul. It's a good return on investment. And it goes to show that slashing, like, spending on bureaucrats' salaries or contracts is not going to reduce overall government spending, because so much of the spending is in Medicare and Social Security. When you have an aging population,
it's hard to cut that.
And I think he understood politically that Elon Musk, even as he was raising the chainsaw above his head, wasn't actually going to slash the things that actually drive government spending.
And I know a lot of people are probably kicking themselves. I should have gone on the poly market and I should have bet some of this.
But this also says something about how poly market and calcium work. You're not betting against the so-called house. You're just betting against other people who want to take the other wager. Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of people out there who are kind of the dupes in this situation saying, well, I saw Elon Musk on TV or X.
And I believed him.
So I'll bet that he actually will reduce government spending. And all this guy Alan Cole is doing is just betting against their bet, right?
Yeah.
Because no, like, actual, you know, old school betting service would put this line out there because mm-hmm. they would know that they would lose. But an average person might take the bet just because
they don't know. Yeah.
They saw Elon out there making all sorts of claims and saying, I believe Elon.
And there you go. Well, congratulations to Cole, 128K. Not
he might
bad,
get a pool,
bad.
Apparently.
Not
he might
bad.
Get a pool. We have to say goodbye to our good folks on YouTube right now. We encourage you to go check out the rest of this episode as a podcast. The link is right there in the description.
Show notes.
Yes. And right now, let's tee it up.
Yes, that does it for our trio of local news stories. And coming up, we're going to be talking about scams. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The bulk of our show today is from one of our favorite recent episodes. It's an insider's look at the $16 billion scam industry and all the nefarious scam attempts regular people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. The tactics range from fake unpaid parking tickets to scammers posing as love interests as a hook to get into your savings.
Investigators say many of these operations come from overseas, especially in large scam farms across Southeast Asia. To unpack it all, we sat down with Bob Sullivan, host of the AARP podcast, The Perfect Scam, to learn about this burgeoning industry and what people can do to protect themselves. Take a listen. And so, Bob, I wanted you to sort of help us level set and give us an understanding of what changed. I feel like the scale of the scams has grown, the number, the sophistication, the types. Can you just kind of give us an overall look at this industry and how it's grown?
Yeah, sure. It's more than your feeling or my feeling. The data backs it up. I've been covering internet crime since we were worried about Y2K. So this is a long bit of research for me. And I can tell you without question, in the last 12 to 24 months, the scale of the problem has just become immense. You know, a year or two ago, you might have heard a friend of a friend who had been hit by one of these things. I promise you, you're going to hear about close family members and friends nearby who have been victims of big crimes and not $300 gift card kind of crimes. But now we're talking about $50,000, $100,000 cryptocurrency fueled crimes. So the number of crimes is up, as you pointed out, and the amount, the severity of the crimes has really exploded for a whole bunch of reasons, which we can get into if you like.
Yeah, let's get into it. So let's talk about the technological changes that have enabled really, really massive scale when it comes to scamming. You talked about cryptocurrency. I think the development of cryptocurrency and the normalization of it is probably one of those. But we hear about other things, SIM farms, spam yeah. centers in Southeast Asia. Let's you know, peel back the layers on what this stuff is and how it enables more scamming.
Yeah, it really is a dark, perfect storm. I think we have to begin with crypto because it's almost the perfect tool if you were to invent an international crime ring. You would invent crypto because you can move money anywhere instantly. For the most part, it's irrevocable. So there's no way to claw it back like you could, say, a credit card transaction. And we even put these machines, which for a large part are fairly diabolical, these Bitcoin ATMs, which I bet some of you have seen now when you yeah. go into a convenience store or a gas station. And, you know, there's already lawsuits arguing that the vast majority of money going through those machines are from victims who are walking up at the instruction of a criminal. Mm. So we've developed this financial network, which is ideal for moving money around the world. But that's not the only factor. The pandemic is still a lingering factor in this. So you've talked about already these forced labor camps. And this story is just, I don't understand why it's not the kind of thing that we're not talking more about. But there are these scam centers, these scam complexes in Southeast Asia, where these poor people show up thinking they're getting a job, and then they take their passport away, and then they are forced to spend 18 hours a day committing crimes, committing scams, committing romance scams or crypto scams or whatnot. Hundreds of thousands of these people, perhaps. And those, the evolution of those crime centers, which began essentially during COVID, when there wasn't much else for some of these urban enterprise zones in Southeast Asia to do, there were casinos that flipped over into these scam complexes. And the professionalization of the crime has allowed for the scale of these crimes to become immense just since, you know, 2020, 2021 or so.
Wow. And I want to, before we bring in, we have callers calling in and we'll get to you in just a moment. But I've heard this term. It's called pig butchering. And it's something that people who, these scammers, these many times forced scammers, they are using this method to sort of hook victims. Could you explain what that term means and how they sort of throw out these traps and ensnare victims?
Sure. And you know, actually, I'm glad you brought that up because one of the great things you said, Cherry, at the very beginning of this segment was this is a shame-free zone. This is a safe mm-hmm. place for us to talk about this. And I just want to digress for a moment because I think that's the most important thing for us to, if I could have 5 seconds of somebody's yes. attention to talk about this topic, it would yes. be the silence is the tool that the criminals all use. Whatever the cover story for, whatever it's a romance scam or a crypto scam, the first instruction is always don't tell anyone. Mm-hmm. And that's very important because often if you just, when you're in the middle of a, say, a transaction, you're buying a car, you're not too sure that this is the car you should buy, you feel weird about it, you tell a friend, even before your friend says, I don't know if that's a good idea, the words coming out of your mouth often persuade you something is not quite right.
Yeah.
It's silence is the biggest tool for these criminals. So there is so much shame associated with crimes like this. And so the term pig butchering, which is being used by law enforcement around the world right now, and it's the concept is basically you get someone involved in a cryptocurrency investment and you persuade them with a fake website that they give you $1,000 and suddenly their $1,000 has grown to 10, 20, 30, 40. So you're fattening the animal, as it were, for a slaughter later. But it's a fairly derogatory term because we're calling the victim a pig there.
Yeah.
And so I try to avoid using that term, but it is a term of art right now that's going around. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying anything negative towards using it exactly, but I'd rather use more positive language that makes it easier for people to come forward. No one wants to raise their hand and say, I've been a victim of the crime. And as long as you've given me this moment to talk about this, I promise you there's someone on the phone right now who's yeah. calling to say, I don't know why anyone would fall for this stuff. I'm too smart for this. Mm-hmm. These people are stupid. And that's a big part of why this crime is so successful, is because we have so much shame and natural criticism around victims of these crimes.
Just one more question about the scale and the tech changes, yeah. Bob, before we get to our callers and commenters. So you mentioned these scam centers in Southeast Asia. Some of them are in Myanmar on the Thai border, for instance, mm-hmm. Where they've professionalized mm-hmm. Scamming and people are essentially trapped in these centers scamming 18 hours a day. In some ways, that feels a little old school. It's sort of human labor, sort of carrying out scams. Are there ways in which scamming has been automated or supercharged by technology to go beyond even what an individual used to be able to do? Like, I've heard about sim farms. I don't know if AI is being deployed yeah. yet to sort of automate scamming. What's like the technological frontier here that might be allowing even the individual scammer to carry out more scams?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've heard there's AI in everything right now, and it's a buzzword. And you probably have heard or seen stories about things like voice cloning, where a criminal can use a tool that costs literally $5 to, you know, by the time we're done with this radio show, they could replicate my voice and call you and have mm-hmm. it sound like me saying, you know, call my mother and say, Bob's in jail and he needs money.
Yeah.
So that is happening. And there are deep fake video clones as well. I'm not as worried about those. Those are kind of sexy uses of AI. But what I am really worried about is the main limiting factor for most of these scam farms is how the English language skills and the colloquial language skills yeah. of the frontline criminals. Mm-hmm. So when they call
it becomes
up and they
a, it's the,
these,
the big red flag is this person doesn't say understand the, yeah. idiomatic English. So therefore yeah, they or, might or, not be in this country.
Or they might say, are you a football fan? What team do you root for? I don't know, the Phillies, you know?
Yeah.
So then, you know, all this person is not really from Philadelphia, right? But AI is so good at adjusting language on the fly. We used to tell people, look for misspellings. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about misspellings anymore. Chat tools, for example, are great for carrying on online romance scams. So that's where an individual frontline criminal can now attack hundreds of people simultaneously, where before there was a limiting factor there.
Wow. I want to bring in a caller who's on the line. Chris from Collegeville, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, this is Chris. I just have a comment, and thanks, Bob, for coming on the air. Bob, actually, you interviewed myself and my wife, Christy, about my father who got scammed. Over $1 million he lost to someone impersonating Alexa Bliss, who's a women's wrestling, you know, very famous women's wrestling champion. And
that story
over the
was
course
so painful.
Of about,
thank you for, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for your interview. You know, I reached a lot of people and our family and friends. But you know, it was just, I connect with two things you said is about the shame. I mean, my dad was always very secretive about it, even though we knew what was happening and it was destroying our family. But also about, you know, just how he, you know, he was a smart guy. He had a lot of common sense. And yet he still fell for it. And he lost all his life savings. And he was about to sell his house, too. So, yeah.
And, Chris, I can hear the emotion in your voice. And I can tell that it still is impacting your family. Is that the case?
Well, yes. I mean, my dad has passed away. He actually he was running after the mailman to mail money to who he thought was Alexa Bliss. And he actually fell and hit his head. So then, you know, he passed away after that 10 days later. But, you know, what he was doing during the time, you know, we tried to convince him and he actually turned against us. He looked at the family as the enemy. You know, he believed the scammer and he lost everything, all his life savings. He was almost 80 years old and, you know, pretty much had nothing left.
He ended up filing a lawsuit against you, right?
He did actually file a lawsuit, thanks for remembering, because I tried to protect some of his money and I moved it into a separate account. And then he actually sued me to get that money released back to him.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was very painful overall.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. That's Chris from Collegeville. And Chris, by the way, we are so sorry about the loss of your father and what happened to you and your family. Bob, just your, if you want to fill out Chris's story, you know, this is, it can be very devastating to people. When these types of scams happen.
I think it's important. Again, I tried to make that point at the beginning. Scams used to be about getting people to send $500 gift cards, but the scale and the pain is so much greater now. That story was so sad because, and we see this all the time, criminals who have somebody under the ether, we sometimes call it, and either, you know, a romance scam or an investment scam or whatnot. One of the first things they say is, you know, don't tell your family, or when your family finds out, don't trust them. That don't believe them, believe me. And people who are under the ether turn against their family, their friends, everybody. I've had family members of victims call me and ask me to help intercede to try to persuade the victim who's in the middle of something that no, this isn't real. Like, I'm a professional journalist. I talk about this all week. Please stop sending this person money. And I've been unable to do that in some cases. It's very, very sad. But that just shows the power of the manipulation here.
So she comments and says, I'm a realtor and just sent out an email to my contacts this morning warning of title fraud. There are imposters posing as homeowners claiming false ownership of real property, transferring deeds to themselves, and using the property to take out loans or even sell. And that brings me to a question about what types of sort of financial transactions or kind of like psychological pain points are out there that scammers like to target. So I could imagine if it had to do with the ownership of my home or my mortgage, these are really, really, really important expenses in my life and a really important piece of property. Anyone messing with that or claiming to mess with that would set off huge alarm bells for me. I would have to take some action to look into it. There are other types of bills that are very important to people, heat and water, et cetera. What are some of the types of transactions that scammers like to pick at because they're manipulating something about our psychology when they're doing that picking?
Almost all these scams are about getting your emotions to go to 11 immediately.
Yeah.
So someone calls and says they're from the IRS, or for me, I don't know about you guys, but if I get a text saying I didn't pay a toll, you know, I remember one time not paying a toll during a road trip through Colorado, and I suddenly got a $100 bill because I was days late paying my toll. You know, so things like that send your emotions right to 11. And one of the generic overarching pieces of advice that we like to give that I think is effective is to just notice when you're in a normal day and suddenly you get a phone call that says you missed jury duty, we're going to arrest you. And so all of a sudden you go from 0 to 10 right away. That's what all criminals try to do. So there is no government agency, and really not even any large company, no electric company, that's going to, in an instant, disconnect your power or come arrest you or ask you for money. All those things happen over weeks in paper. And so the pause when you feel an emotional surge like that is really, really important.
Yeah, if the dire consequences are up front, that's a red flag, because usually there's a step, there are steps to get to the most dire consequences when it comes to violating the law or missing a payment.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. And by the way, I want to remind our listeners that you can participate in this conversation. Shame aside, this is a safe space. Have you or someone you know been scammed? You can share your story. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave your comments in the chat. Bob, I want to talk about entry points because, you know, you're thinking like, how did they even get my email? How did they, you know, get my phone number? How do they even know these facts about me? How do they know my name? Because sometimes it feels so personal. So how are these scammers getting access to this level of data from you or about you to where you can even be hooked into the scam?
It's such an important point because so many of these scams are so personal, and that's why they're believable. I mentioned I've been writing about cybercrime since before Y2K. Well, I bet you have been hearing about big data leaks since before Y2K, right? Hundreds of millions of records being stolen from credit bureaus or from government agencies. All that data is sitting in these databases in the dark web that criminals can access. And so it's rather trivial to find out, you know, things like when your birthday is, what your dog's pets, what your pet's name was, where, you know, the mascot of your high school. But it even goes more detailed than that. To answer the question that's always in everybody's head, how could you fall for that? Here's just an example of somebody I interviewed not too long ago, a woman who was recently widowed, married for 60 something years. And the day after her husband passed away, she gets a call from someone who says they're from her husband's insurance company, life insurance, and says, we have to do this in order to get a payout. And you know, imagine yourself after, you know, the grief alone. But then during funerals, you end up signing a million pieces of paper just to get it all out of the way, right? So you sign one more, but that one signs over your life insurance payment. And that's why we say over and over again on The Perfect Scam that if you haven't been the victim of a scam, it just hasn't been your turn yet. It's really all about the timing and circumstance. So the story that someone presents to you, if they get you in the right moment, under the right circumstances, you probably would be a victim too. And it's really important to have that mentality.
Yeah. Want to bring in a caller? We have Brad from Pottstown on the line. Brad, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to point out a scam that they tried on my grandfather. My son was graduating from college, and they saw him enlisted in the graduating class, and they called his grandfather to say he had been arrested in town, you know, under the influence, and that they needed bail money to release him. And my father called me to say my son had been arrested, and my reaction was, go right to jail, go to the county jail, and get him released. My dad went to the police station, and they said there was nobody there by that name. He went to the state police. There was nobody there by that name. He went to city police. There was nobody there by that name. There was a scam. Yeah. They were trying to get money, bail money for my son, but they scanned the graduating classes.
Wow.
And looked for graduate names.
Thank you. That's Brad from Pottstown. I mean, that's one of the ways people get access to your information. And Bob, you know, the other day I was on Instagram and someone says, you know, give me some old names, like your grandmother's name. And people were literally listing names of grandmas and aunties. And somebody posted in the comments, you should not be doing this. These are security questions. So I just wonder, like, you know, just ordinary things people post online and they don't think about the privacy issues that could pop up and make them more vulnerable. Because I wonder, are the scammers getting this type of information just from ordinary posts?
I mean, I don't know specifically from that post, but yes is the answer. I mean, about every 4 months, another game comes around where, you know, you could click this button and it turns your face into a rabbit ears or something, right? Or see what you would look like when you were 110 years old. All of those things, people should just not engage with any of them. The cost benefit, there's no way to assess the cost benefit. This is one of the big problems with the internet. When you fill out a form, you play a game today, you don't know how it's going to be used against you 5 years from now. And so just don't engage.
Yeah.
So that brings up the specter of the large social media companies. Mm-hmm. Their platforms are being used to collect people's information, mm-hmm. legally and illegally, and they're a key link in the chain of these scams. And I guess the question I have for you, Bob, is what responsibility do they bear, and could we change criminal statutes to make it so that they have to at least try to be aware of the scammers on their platforms?
Well, we as a society have to wrestle with this question, and we have to wrestle with it pretty immediately. There was a great Reuters story last week suggesting that Meta, specifically Instagram, Facebook, and other tools, plays a role in about a third of all scams that happen. Many of the first contacts happen over Facebook Messenger, for example, or Instagram. Instagram is a hotbed for cryptocurrency scams. And there's a lot more, a lot of us believe, that Meta could do specifically, social media in general, but Meta specifically could do.
Because their response, of course, is going to be, Bob, well, there's billions of accounts. How could we possibly figure out mm-hmm. which of these are scammers, which of these are legitimate people? Is that a legitimate defense, or are there things that they could do to weed out bad actors?
If you owned a mall and you had a problem with gangs having fights in your mall, you would be forced to hire more security guards, just as a matter of business. And so I think these technology companies have for a long time gotten away with saying, well, you know, we're not committing the crime, we're not responsible for it. But if crime is happening using your tools under your nose for years and hurting millions of people to the tune of billions of dollars, I think you bear some responsibility, and we're going to have to figure that out.
And a quick follow-up to you, Bob, because according to Reuters, Meta earned about 10% of its ad revenue from scams and other prohibited ads. Are some of these platforms sort of getting a cut of, you know, from these victims in a sense, that they're actually helping the scammers scam people?
Yeah, and that story also pointed out that Facebook had a scoring for whether this ad was a scam or not. And unless the ad scored stronger than 95%, they would allow it. So they knew there was a high statistical probability that these crimes were being committed, and they were collecting money for it. So, again, this is a question for larger society, but I think we need to look at these platforms. And while I've been working in consumer education my whole life, the truth is consumer education is a small part of how we fix this problem. We need to go to the experts and the facilitators and choke this crime off at the origin point, because, you know, as we keep talking, I can educate people till I'm blue in the face, and still criminals are going to be often one step ahead.
Yeah, real quick, what's a potential fix, or like the outline mm-hmm. of a potential fix? Because we can't fix human nature. We're always going to be psychologically vulnerable to scammers, as we have been for millennia. What is the system fix that can make it so the internet is not such an efficient facilitator of scams?
Yeah, well, let's go back to the beginning of when credit cards became the big deal that they are. As soon as there was a rule that said consumers aren't responsible for losses with their credit cards,
yep.
credit card companies fought that, but credit cards themselves exploded. And I think we need to create some kind of liability akin to that, so these tech companies are more responsible for stuff that happens on their platforms.
All of a sudden, your credit card company is pretty darn interested in whether yeah. or not fraud is occurring. And what they're pointing out is that if Facebook, et cetera, don't seem all that interested. So that's a good point.
And that was part of our conversation with Bob Sullivan, host of the AARP podcast, The Perfect Scam. In just a moment, we'll bring in a former FBI agent and cybersecurity expert with more tips for how you and your loved ones can stay safe as scammers evolve with all sorts of new technology.
And we're taking your emails this hour. Have you been the victim of a scam? Tell us your story. Email studio2@whyy.org.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We've been talking this hour about the $16 billion scam industry, how it works, and what you can do to keep your loved ones safe. The bulk of our program today is on tape, but we'd still love to hear from you. If you have a scam story you want to share with us, email studio2@whyy.org.
Staying with us through the end of the hour is Bob Sullivan, host of the AARP podcast, The Perfect Scam. And joining us for the final segment of the show is former FBI counterintelligence operative Eric O'Neill. He's also the author of Spies, Lies, and Cybercrime. Eric, we want to bring you into the conversation by sort of starting with where scams fall on the priority list for law enforcement. Because a lot of times we see these types of things proliferate because they're not necessarily being given top priority, in your commentary on that.
Well, they're not. And I wish that they were given higher priority, but you have so many law enforcement officers and so many things that they are tracking down. And scams are very difficult for law enforcement. The anonymity of the dark web makes it very easy for cyber criminals and scammers and fraudsters to launch attacks in places that have no extradition to the U.S. And in fact, countries like Russia and China, two of the biggest threat actors against the United States, allow their cyber criminals to attack us with impunity and very rarely take any action against them. It's only when there is incredible pressure from our administration here and we can see them, and usually it's a critical infrastructure-like attack. So, you know, what I've been saying for all these years is that we need to protect ourselves. We need to be the first line of defense against these scams. We are not going to, unfortunately, have law enforcement ride in and stop them. Now, they try. They do go into the dark web. They do smash their servers. They steal their decryption keys. They hand them out like Halloween candy to people who have been locked by ransomware. But bad guys have backups, too. And what they do is they just restore from backup. They use the same cybersecurity tactics of resilience, and they come back and they rebrand with a new name and launch attacks again.
Mm. Wow. Want to bring in another caller now. This is Barbara from Mount Laurel on line three. Hey, Barbara, do you have a story to share about being scammed or an attempted scam?
Yes, I do. I had a shocking discovery this year when I noticed on my Medicare statements that over $50,000 had been charged, attributed to me for an operation in Florida. It took many phone calls with Medicare to even get some information from them. And I found out that the scam was through a company that was charging Medicare $18,000 for wound care dressings for my gender reassignment surgery. Mm-hmm. And Medicare not only paid it once, but after they were notified, they paid it again a couple months later, and now they're paying for my dialysis treatments from my gender reassignment surgery.
Hmm. Wow, and you are not getting any of these services, correct?
Just to be clear. No, I'm a 74-year-old woman in New Jersey who's never been to Delray Beach, Florida. I checked on the internet. I found out that this company is just a P.O. box down in Florida. They've scammed people through my secondary insurance companies, lost $2 billion.
Wow.
Because they pay the 20% that Medicare doesn't pay. Wow. But I've reported it to everyone from my state senators, congressmen, the federal agencies, the Medicare, they just keep paying them. Meanwhile, the Medicare refused to pay my $90 chiropractor bill.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad at the very least you were able to get some resolution on the phony charges, and I'm sorry that the legitimate charges are still causing you issues. Thank you so much,
Barbara
from Mount Laurel.
Yes, everyone should check their statements.
Absolutely.
Be very vigilant about checking your Medicare statements if you're a senior.
Yeah,
Thank you.
I'll kick this back to you, Eric O'Neill. You talked about protecting yourself. So what can you do to protect yourself?
Barbara
says check your statements. I guess that's a place to start.
She brings up an incredibly important point that I think everyone right now needs to have that identity theft monitoring. It's like installing cybersecurity. It's that early warning system that someone has stolen your identity, has your social security number, has your credit card, and is using it for fraud. Because that early warning, and then you can take action fast, is one of the most important things to do. Barbara, if I were you, I would freeze my credit. You can go to each of the main credit agencies and request that they They freeze now. Actually, they make it easy. You can go online, use an account. Do not lose your password or two-factor authentication because it's very hard to get it back. And you can actually just toggle it on and off if you need to open up a credit card or get credit. But freezing those your credit with those three agencies can help a lot. And this Medicare scam is like so many other scams where attackers are inserting them in a process that people rely on. And they know that there is a lot of fraud and abuse in Medicare, and they exploit that. And at the same time, they're using identities that they steal in order to file these false and sometimes malicious claims. And you see these PO boxes where people, and sometimes they're not even in the United States, are using them. And sometimes they hire people. They have criminals here in the U.S. who help facilitate it on their behalf. And they're pretty large and sophisticated gangs. And I'll just add, you know, law enforcement has trouble with this too. The IC3, the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, just issued a statement today that scammers are pretending to be the IC3 and are reaching out to people saying, you know, you've been the victim of a cybercrime. Wow. We're the FBI, and we're here to help you, and then scamming them.
Wow. I want to read this comment. Margaret says the pervasive power of scams can result in mistrust of factual information and offers of help people have requested. I was a volunteer, she says, calling to provide help to voters who have requested help with problems filling out mail-in ballots this fall. In a few cases, the individuals thought I could be an AI rather than a real person. And when I offered to text links to official PA voter information websites, some people worried that the website could be fake. So I want to sort of talk about that a little bit. Can you give us some red flags? Because Bob talked about this earlier, Eric.
Right.
He said, look, you know, there used to be these little red flags where you could see typos in the emails, or you could look at it and you could tell that the email was from some weird country. But the AI proliferation in the scams has cleaned all that up. What are some red flags that should tell you, okay, this is not, I need to question this. This may not be real.
That's a really good point. And I've been saying for some time that thanks to AI and deepfakes, trust has become a very uncommon commodity. So we have to be very careful, whether it's a call from, I think Bob gave a quick example of a call from your daughter saying, I got in a car wreck. And then you're talking to the public defender who says, you need to wire me $2,000 or she's going to spend the next 2 weeks in jail. Or it's this belief, right? Because this is the thing that AI is doing. As we see more and more of it, people are not even believing what's true because they think it might be AI. So what can you do? The first thing is never fall for urgency. These scams are always going to try to put you in a position where there's urgency to do something right now, and you can't wait and you can't stop and take a breath and think. And like Bob said earlier, the best thing you can do is stop, take a breath, and reach out to a friend and say, does this sound right? The other thing is, if it sounds too good to be true, there's no way it's true. Just assume that it's a scam and then try to find a way to see if it is true. And you can do that through what we call like a second level verification. Reach out directly, in this case, to the voting registration administration and then say, hey, is this true? Is this real? Always call with a line that you know is real, right? Or a way of communicating that you know, because you've researched and looked up that this is their official number, as opposed to ever using anything that comes to you unsolicited. And that's just the world we're in right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of too good to be true, we've cited this number before, over $16 billion lost to internet criminals in the U.S. last year alone, 33% rise. Well, of that $16 billion, according to the FBI, $6.5 billion is from investment fraud. And I bet a lot of those investment offers do seem too good to be true. So something to watch out for. Victor from Overbrook is on the line and has a story to share. Victor, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective?
Good afternoon. My kids are 18 and 19. And I just wanted to say that at their high school, which was a private high school, they both had internet safety courses that taught them how to avoid scams and also things like sexting and that kind of thing. And I think it's something that's really important, along with financial literacy in high schools, to teach kids how to do this. I remember in the 80s when I was growing up, and they did the big campaign about seatbelts. And everybody said, go home and tell your parents they have to wear your seatbelts. And all I know is I always wore my seatbelt and, you know, yelled at my dad and mom to wear theirs. And eventually they got the message. So I think if you teach the kids in high school, they'll tell their parents, they'll tell their grandparents. And that's a good first step, I think.
I like that call from Victor. However, I will say, like, you know, we have to take like cyber security training at work. And sometimes you do roll your eyes a little bit. You're like, is this really working? I do this once a quarter. Does this actually sink in? And sometimes I'm a little skeptical of like education is the answer if we don't like actually change the systemic problems. But Bob, I'm curious for your take on like more formalized education as an answer to the problem here, or will we kind of some percentage of us always fall back into these traps because that's human nature? Your thoughts, Bob.
Well, I'm glad to hear your skepticism, which I share. I do think that it's a trap for, you know, large companies that are used. Well, it's a misdirection play. I would say large companies that are used for crimes to say, oh, we need to do education. We'll pay for some pamphlets. However, of course, education can play a role. And teenagers, you pointed out earlier, and I think this is going to surprise a lot of people, but while the consequences for elderly people who fall for scams are more severe because they're older and they often can lose almost all of their life savings or have it stolen from them, but younger people are actually more frequent victims of crimes. Mm-hmm. And so there are crypto crimes, for example, ravaging Instagram right now, and it usually begins with an account takeover. So you don't get a message from an unexpected person. You get a message from a friend, a longtime friend, who says suddenly, hey, I just invested in this new crypto coin. You should do it too. So I think training for young people is really important. And I interviewed the family of a young man who, a terribly horrible story, who was the victim of a sextortion crime and ultimately took his life a couple of months ago. And I can tell you that episode disturbed me for weeks. These stories are very, very sad. I just read about another example of this happening just a couple of days ago. And that's the kind of thing that we really need to educate young people about. And that story is so deeply about shame. And, you know, somebody went from nowhere to a contact to within 3 hours of taking their own lives because of what happened in a sextortion scam. And so we do need to do all of these things. And education is actually an important component.
Wow. I want to bring in another caller. We have Marita from Flemington on the line. Marita, you're on Studio 2. I hope I said your name right. What's your story?
It's not a story. It's very simple. There's a function on most phones, on my Android, and I think on all phones, that it's an app, and you can put it in, and it says screen call. And if your system doesn't recognize the number,
and we lost Marita there. But
don't answer the phone. It's a perfectly good piece of advice nowadays. Yeah. Really, yeah.
And I want to throw this out there because Alan from Bridgeton says, why can't telecommunications companies stop spam callers? I mean, you know, especially, I mean, I'm a journalist. Sometimes I get calls from people who are not in my contacts, and sometimes I answer. So I just wonder, like, are there protections that people can employ that would keep some of these scammers away? And I guess Eric, you could comment. Yeah,
sure. You can add your phone number to the do not call registry and it won't really do a lot of good. It'll stop some of the spam, the legitimate spam, but unfortunately not the criminal spam. You know, the best thing you can do is like Bob said, don't answer the call. You know, now I don't have an Android. I have an Apple. And they have this great new feature where you can ignore it. It goes to voicemail and you can in real time see the voicemail on your phone in text. I love this because then I can decide whether I want to answer or not. But my rule is never to answer a phone call that I don't recognize, that's not in my contacts. If it's important, they'll leave a voicemail. And never, ever respond to a text. You will get texts all day long that just say, hey, or I missed you at the barbecue, or hey, how's it going? We saw each other last week at the party, or just random things. These are smishing attacks. It's a text phishing attack that are trying to find polite people who respond. And when you respond, they will get you into a long conversation. They're looking for lonely people. They're looking for people who are polite. And they're looking for people who need a friend. And that can be an incredible gateway to romance fraud, to a financial pig butchering attack, to so many other ways of scamming you.
As we get ready to wrap up, where is all this heading? What's the frontier of cybercrime? I have this great quote from Bruce Schneier at Harvard who says, watch where the computers go. That's where the crime goes. Well, we have self-driving cars now. I mean, where computers are really everywhere. Yeah. Real quick, Erica, what's the next wave?
Certainly, I think cybercrime is going to grow. This year, we're going to see, and into 2026, we're going to see an explosion of deep fake attacks. It's going to make it much harder to detect these crimes. Cybercrime has grown to over $14 trillion in this year. By next year, it'll be 18, and the following year, over 20. That makes it larger than the third largest economy on Earth. And so what I think technology has to do to respond is to use our own AI to defend against it. And I will bet within the next number of months, we're going to be seeing companies that provide some sort of layer that we install that is a deepfake detector.
We just heard from Eric O'Neill, former FBI counterintelligence operative and author of Spies, Lies, and Cybercrime, and Bob Sullivan, host of the AARP podcast, The Perfect Scam. Now, a bunch of folks wrote in with their scam stories. So, Avi, let's let folks hear some of those.
Yeah, Laura from Devon wrote in about her 93-year-old stepfather who, along with two of his Harvard MBA friends, invested in gold mines in Ghana. Laura tried to involve the FBI, but agents said they couldn't act unless he admitted he was being scammed. A reverend wrote in to say that he often has parishioners who receive supposedly emails from him asking for gift cards, and he has to repeatedly warn people against that. And Stephen from Denver, Colorado says, a family member of mine was being scammed, and I learned that pushing back too hard only made him shut me out. Instead, I focused on helping without reacting too harshly to his situation. And thanks to Rebecca from Coatesville, Elizabeth, and many others who wrote in.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for sharing your stories. We really appreciate that. And of course, I gotta thank our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.